February 18th, Daniel 3, Blazing Courage. Okay, so we're on live on tape now. Let's go to Daniel chapter 3. And as we begin, what's the background? Where are we as we start Daniel 3? What happened in Daniel 1 and 2? Anybody want to give me a quick 2-second summary? Yes, Jerusalem is the capital of the southern kingdom of Judah. And it was finally conquered by the Babylonians. Now, just a little Old Testament reminder for you. There was a united kingdom under, who was the first king? Under the first king was not David, it was Saul. Saul was the first king. Then David, then David's son Solomon. After Solomon, there's a divided kingdom. There's all kinds of issues that happened. And Solomon's son Rehoboam cannot keep the kingdom together. The northern 10 tribes split away, form what is known as Israel. The southern kingdom becomes known as Judah. So for a number of years, decades, you have two parts of Israel, the north and the south. The northern kingdom starts out bad and goes downhill from there, has a series of really awful kings. God sends some really good prophets. Elijah, Elisha, ministers the northern kingdom primarily. And eventually, what happens? The northern kingdom, they're conquered by Assyria, which is the big bad guy on the block at that time. Several decades go by. The southern kingdom remains independent, but gets beaten up on numerous occasions by the Assyrians, by the Babylonians, who take over. Assyria was modern-day Iraq. Babylon kind of is the next empire in that same area. Babylon eventually takes over Israel, or takes over Jerusalem, takes over Judah. And Babylon has this great strategy for when they conquer a territory. What do? To keep it conquered, to keep it under their thumb, what do?
Take the best and brightest back.
That's right. You take the best and the brightest of that area, because they're going to be the troublemakers if you leave them there. They're going to be the ones that lead the rebellion against you. So you take them, the best and the brightest, you take them back to your turf, and you train them to be good administrator, good servants, good merchants, good whatever in your kingdom, in your place. So the Babylonians exported, it's called the exile. They took a whole bunch of the best of the Jews, the best of the Israelites, and they took them back to Babylon. Again, modern day Iraq, along the Euphrates, Tigris rivers there in that Mesopotamia area. So they took them back there and helped and sort of allowed them to live, peaceful, prosperous lives, merchants, tradesmen, craftsmen, and the best of those became administrators and servants in the Babylonian Empire. They became the IRS agents and the FBI agents and the governors they became those roles, which you think is kind of weird to allow foreigners to be those, but it's really smart if you've trained them up in your system and then you put them in place and you have a lot of gifted people working for you. That's what happened with the four young men we meet in chapter 1. Daniel and his buddies become sort of special trainees of the royal academy. They're brought into the king's household. They're fed from the king's table. They're trained by the king's own staff to be future officials. That makes sense? So these are favored ones. In chapter 1 and chapter 2, we meet them. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. And again, it's in my helpful notes, but I find it really interesting. They're all given Babylonian names, but only Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego actually are referred to by those Babylonian names. Anybody remember Daniel's Babylonian name? Belshazzar. Yeah. So maybe it's just hard to say, and we don't like to say it, so maybe that's why. Or maybe the book was authored by somebody who was tutored by Daniel, and Daniel wanted to be referred to by his Hebrew name, so he retains his. The other three don't. So what happens is those four kind of band together, stay true to their faiths, true to God. In chapter 1, they're kind of distinct. They rise to the attention of the king. They're trustworthy, they're loyal, they're faithful, they get a lot of work done. And so the king puts them in positions of influence, in positions of power, and they continue to succeed, and everything's going great. But what happens when faithful ones to God are doing great? Somebody who's watching them is going to get jealous and envious and going to start causing trouble. And that's what happens in chapter 3. So we're going to read chapter 3, 30 verses of it at least. featuring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, otherwise known as Rack, Shack, and Benny, if you happen to watch any of your VeggieTales. So I may be referring to them by those names at some point. If you've never seen that particular VeggieTale, it's awesome. It's about 20 years old. The earliest VeggieTales are amazing, and then they kind of get bad as it goes along. But they get, because the company gets too big and too secular and taken over by, I don't know, Disney or somebody. So the earlier VeggieTales, though, are very authentic to Scripture, very true to Scripture, and just very funny. So one of the, I think the second or third one they made, maybe the fourth one, was on this story, the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But it's far too difficult to say those names over and over again. So they shorten them to Rack, Shack, and Benny. And do you remember what the golden statue is in the VeggieTale? Oh, nobody knows their VeggieTales. What is it? Yeah, it's a big chocolate bunny. It's a big chocolate bunny. It's awesome, just so you know. And they sing a whole song about the bunny. And I will not sing that for you. But yes, so it's quite fun. But so if you happen to catch me saying Rack, Shack, and Benny, that's who I mean. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. All right, with all that aside, somebody want to read for me verses 1 through 3.
King Nebuchadnezzar made a gold statue 9 feet tall and 9 feet wide and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then he sent messages to the high officers, officials, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the provincial officials to come to the dedication of the statue he had set up. So all these officials came and stood before the statue King Nebuchadnezzar had set up.
Okay. Two things to note. This particular book of the Bible is influenced by the region where it took place. Persia, Babylon, that whole area is known for its storytelling style. The Scheherazade and the 1001 Tales and all that good stuff. It's a manner of telling a story where you make sure you include all the details. Like, did you notice how many officials there are? All different categories. Because there's a rhythm to storytelling. And when you're telling a story verbally, not written, but verbal, you want to draw in the reader with all the intonation of your voice and the repetition, the way you can use your voice. And so all those details sound kind of weird when you're reading them from a printed page. But if you're a storyteller sitting around a campfire, then it would draw you in, engage you in. So you'll catch that detail over and over again, where they're not going to just say one. He called all the officials together. That's the way we would say it in Western English, right? But in the ancient Near East, especially Persia area, they would give you all the officials just to draw you in with the details. So keep that in mind as you see this passage. Okay, so what's taking place? King Nebuchadnezzar, who granted is a powerful king, the Babylonian Empire is at the height of their power under him. He is a great emperor in a lot of ways. He's conquered a whole lot of territory. So he wakes up one day and, you know, I just don't have enough attention yet. I must be on the cover of every magazine. I must be on every TV show. I just don't have enough spotlight yet. I want to be like those Kardashian creeps. I want to be like them and have so much attention. So what am I going to do, says King Nebuchadnezzar? I'm going to build me a statue. And not just any statue. How tall is it? How tall is that? Think about that. 9 stories tall. A lot of times we blaze right by the details, but think about how tall that would be in that day and age. How many buildings in Modesto are 9 stories tall? You know, they're not many. That's huge. And how thick is it again? And it's made from?
Gold.
Think about that in modern day prices of gold per ounce. And that's 90 feet tall and 9 feet thick. That's a pretty impressive statue. Not to mention gold is hard to work with because it's a soft metal. So this would have taken a lot of craftsmanship and a lot of structural, you know, shoring up. And it would have been quite a project for his engineers. But he, in his pridefulness, says, I want that statue to be. It most likely was an image of him. We don't know that for certain.
I couldn't find that.
Yeah, we don't know that for certain. That's what's interesting. He just basically says, I want a statue. We never find out if it's of him. But the context would lean towards the fact that he is somehow being honored by the statue, yes. It may not be of him, but it's his personal god, perhaps, or his personal... It's somehow connected to him. We don't know if it's exactly of him or not, but it's basically his pridefulness going, I want to do this, and more importantly, I'm going to accomplish this, yes, but what's going to happen when I have this unveiled? Am I just going to have it appear one day? No, it's going to be a big old show. I'm going to invite all of my officials, and there's going to be a whole lot of stuff going on around this. It's a very prideful situation here that he's doing. So, what happens? 4-6?
Then a herald shouted out, "People of all races and nations and languages, listen to the king's command. When you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and other musical instruments, bow to the ground to worship King Nebuchadnezzar's gold statue. Anyone who refuses to obey will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace."
Okay. Now, again, most of the context implies there's a statue of him or somehow connected to him. And so what does he do? He has a statue built. How long would it have taken to have that built? You know, quite a while. We have no idea how long, but months and months and months. When it's finally ready, and again, how hard is it to hide that size statue? Everybody knows it's being built. It's not like a trade secret or something. So it's been going on and become this buzz around the empire for quite a while. When it's finally ready, he has the engraved invitations arrive at all of his officials all over his empire. They all have to travel to the capital area. They all have to be there on that day when it's unveiled and revealed. And what is the setup here? What's he wanting them to do? Now, why? Why would he do this? Yeah, definitely pride, and he thinks he's special. Definitely, that's part of it. But it's also a really smart way to secure your power. You get all of your officials from all the different parts of the empire to travel in. They all have to take flights and drive overnight and take the Greyhound bus to Babylon and all that, all gathered together. And what does he make them do when they're there? It's essentially swearing an oath to him by bowing down and worshiping this statue. So he's basically saying, I don't care what language you speak. I don't care where you're from. I don't care what province you govern or what role you have, whether you're a clerk or a governor or whatever. You're going to come to Babylon. You're all going to be in one place. And I'm going to essentially make you bow down and see and sort of swear to my greatness. Swear your loyalty, but also swear your worship to my statue. Now, whether that's of him or just of his making, it's still the same thing. He's basically saying, I'm king, you're not. I'm great, you're not. I'm the best, bow down to me, or else. And what's the or else, by the way? Yeah, it's not just a slap on the wrist, I'll fine you. It's not just I'm going to put you in the penalty box for a few minutes or something. It's not a pleasant fate. It's not a pleasant way to die in any way, shape, or form. And it's very much a spectacle. It's very much a showy way of executing somebody. It's not just, hey, we're going to kill you. It's, hey, we're going to kill you in a really gruesome, horrible fashion. And it's going to be a lesson to everybody else because it's going to be a horrible way to go. And it's going to have that effect that nobody else wants to go that way. So I'm going to make sure that you are afraid of me because I hold the power of life and death over you. So think about that.
Ryan, can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Nebuchadnezzar says, surely your God is the God of gods and mm-hmm. the Lord of kings,
mm-hmm.
Because this mystery was revealed
through Daniel
to me. Mm-hmm. So is he in any way worshiping God at this point, or does he just say that and trash that thought? Now he's back to himself.
Yeah, the way it's laid out in chapter 3 is he's either forgotten that whole thing, or he doesn't really get it and doesn't really care, because chapter 3, clearly he doesn't go to Daniel and say, how can I honor your God and let me find a way to set up a temple for your God? Or, you know, there's no connection back to the God of Daniel. He's doing this on his own, and most likely it's pridefully motivated. So most whatever happened in chapter 2, and interestingly enough, that's a good point. What happens to Nebuchadnezzar eventually? Oh, yeah. And ultimately, he's humbled. Basically, God says, enough of your pridefulness. I've sent you Daniel. I've sent you others to be examples. I've sent you, and several times, he has these near conversion kind of things where he says, you'll see one in the lesson today, where he basically says, oh, great is your God, Daniel. Boy, he is amazing. And great is the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And boy, he saved you. And I just want to know that God. And then all of a sudden, the next chapter, it's, where'd all that go? Out the window. And it's eventually God humbles him in a pretty dramatic, horrible way, really. And he loses his mind for a while and pretends he's a cow, essentially. So it's a fascinating story. But yeah, that's a great point. Chapter 2 does have him at least honoring God, not quite converting to follow God, but all that's out the window by chapter 3. Other questions? And again, what's the signal for everybody to bow down? And he can't just say when the instrument plays. When the music plays, what does the storyteller tell you again? When you hear the sound of the harp and the brass and the drums and the guitar and the synthesizer and the handbells and the... Okay, not quite handbells, but you know what I mean. He lists all those instruments. When the band plays, essentially, that's your signal to bow down. So we have quite the setup here. Everything's looking, you know, pretty... We have the convention of all the leaders of the kingdom, of the empire. Everybody's there. We have this gathering. Everything's going to be great, except for those leaders that follow the true God. Because what is one of the big 10 commandments that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego know and want to follow? Thou shalt have no other God before me. That's one of the big, one of the top four. And thou shalt not make any graven images. No idols, no idolatry. So two out of the 10, yeah. And don't bear false witness, so you can't just pretend and kind of go halfway down to bow, or, you know, pretend you're tying your shoe and just kind of pretend you're... No, you can't do that, because that's, you don't want to do that. So they already are set up to have a conflict here. Questions, comments? Knock-knock jokes, riddles, perhaps? All right, 7 through 12, whoever has that.
So at the sound of the musical instruments, all the people, whatever their race or nation or language, bowed to the ground and worshipped the gold statue that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. But some of the astrologers went to the king and informed on the Jews. They said to the king, Nebuchadnezzar, long live the king. You issued a decree requiring all people to bow down and worship the gold statue when they hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and other musical instruments. That decree also states that those who refuse to obey must be thrown into the blazing furnace. But there are some Jews, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, whom you have put in charge of the province of Babylon. They pay no attention to you, Your Majesty. They refuse to serve your gods and do not worship the gold statue you have set up.
All right. So we have the big occasion. The music plays. Do you notice again, it's not just the people that were there. It's the people from every nation, tribe, tongue, and blah, blah, blah. It's that crazy storytelling way. Aren't you glad I don't talk like that, you know? Or I don't teach like that, or I don't preach like that, or that I don't daily refer to myself as Brian, or Brian Ralston, or Brian Scott, or the six different ways I can refer to myself. That would be so annoying to listen to on a regular basis, huh? But what's our situation? The music plays, people bow down, but somebody's watching. Somebody's always watching. And what do the astrologers... First of all, who are those guys? Who are the astrologers?
Sorcerers.
Yes. They're part of sort of the king's entourage. They're kind of one of his departments of government, where he has his magicians, his fortune tellers. Every kingdom in the ancient world, except for Israel, has these kind of guys hanging around. Egypt had them. The Pharaoh had them. Babylon has them. Where they're just sort of... There's always this human desire to know the future and to interpret the skies, the stars and the galaxies and all that, and to somehow connect those two. That we'll somehow know the future by looking at the stars or looking at the planets. There's that in almost human... Every human culture has that somehow, where we have this... It's a natural desire to know the future, right? And so we try to find ways to do that. And to interpret dreams and all that. So on his staff, he has these guys. And these guys, how do they think of this? These Jewish folks? Because chapter 2, what did Daniel do? He trumped them. Essentially, he basically said, y'all don't know what you're talking about. I have been given this gift by the one true God, and I can tell the king what his dreams mean, and y'all are just out the door. And so he's embarrassed them. He's in competition with them. So they're not real happy about this, these Jewish folks, these Jewish imports, you know, and so they are looking for an opportunity to get them all. This time they have a chance to get Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We don't know where Daniel is, just so you know. We don't know why he isn't caught in this trap either. We have no idea. So I have no answer for that one because, I don't know, maybe he took a little vacation. I don't know. But he's not there in this scene, so we don't have anything to do with Daniel. But they can take out these other three, and what do? They go to the king and they narc. They tell. They go to him and they squeal on these three. Hey, king. And notice how they approach him. Long live the king. Got to kiss up a little bit before. And what do they say? Oh, king, here's what you said. You passed the decree, and you said, and they have to repeat it word for word. And these Jewish imports, they aren't doing that. In fact, you put them in charge of the province of Babylon. You put them in a position of authority, king, and now look how they're repaying you. Look at their disloyalty. Look at their... And they basically talk smack about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They didn't bow down to your statue. They don't worship your gods. They don't respect you. They are a public shaming of you, essentially. You put them in a high position, and they are repaying that by thumbing their noses at you and ignoring what's valuable to you, and they are publicly dissing you, king. They just are publicly shaming you. And they call him out. They basically say, you better do something about this, because they're out there, and they're causing trouble, and you better assert your authority, king, or are you a scaredy cat? Are you afraid to do anything to these? That's kind of what they're doing. They're putting him in a corner, and there's only way out for a maniacal, prideful king. There's only one way out of that. So what's any questions, comments on 7 through 12?
Brand Mount, the province, yeah. Babylon, it's mentioned twice. Is this a separate
deal? Again, Babylon being very smart, what they had done was divide their territory into states, into provinces, and essentially put various people in charge of them. So in the state, in the county of Babylon, they had put these three as some of the lead officials in that province, in that area. So it's just an administrative zone, an administrative territory. And they had all, I think they had 120 some of them, just because you can control an area better if you subdivide it, essentially. Yeah, other questions? Are y'all tired of the zithers and all those instruments being listed? Yeah, me too, but we're done with that, so... So how does good old Nebi react? Just so you know, in the VeggieTales, he's Nebi K. Nezer. His last name is Nezer, which I find awesome. All right. Let's read 13 through 15.
Then Nebuchadnezzar flew into a rage and ordered Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to be brought before him. When they were brought in, Nebuchadnezzar said to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you used to serve my gods or worship the gold statue I have set up? I will give you one more chance to bow down and worship the statue I have made when you hear the sound of the musical instruments. But if you refuse, you will be thrown immediately into the blazing furnace. And then what god will be able to rescue you from my power?
Thank you, Nebuchadnezzar, for not listing the musical instruments. Okay, so why does he give him another chance? Okay, so verse 13, he flies into a rage. That's what we expect to happen. His advisors have kind of manipulated him into this situation. He's angry. He's prideful. He flies into a flying rage, and then he gives him a second chance. Because the first impression you get is he's so angry. Get those three. Drag them in here, and we know what's going to happen to them. They're going to get thrown right into the old campfire. But that's not what happens right away, right? Why does he give them a second chance? Because they're so valuable. Because they have proven themselves to be so valuable. And he has a special place in his heart for them because they've come up, they've been trained, they've been raised up in his own kingdom, I mean, his own royal academy, essentially. Now, he doesn't consider them sons or anything like that. He doesn't love them in that sense, but he has a special place in his heart because they were part of one of his little pet projects that went really well. To bring these guys from Judah and train them up into being great, and boy, this has been some of his success stories. There's been research projects written about these guys. There's been a whole, you know, there's been a whole series of successes that he has been able to take credit for because his little plan worked until now. And so he wants to give him a second chance because he's going, maybe those were just jealous reports. Maybe those were just envy. Maybe that was people trying to manipulate me. So I'm going to give him a second chance. And he very clearly articulates a second chance, right? Is it really true? And you can hear the pleading in his voice. Is it really true? It can't be true. Not you three. Not my favored students who've done so well as my trusted, underlings. You've done so well. You're so valuable to me. All you have to do is bow down. It's not really that big of a deal. Let's try it again. Let's play the music. Boys, cue up the zithers, and let's give this another try. When you hear, we'll just pretend that first time didn't happen. Let's have a mulligan, a do-over. Let's just pretend that that whole big scene didn't happen. They did that in public. They shamed him in public. In front of all those other officials, they did not bow down. Everybody else did. These guys didn't. So that shows you how valuable they are. He's given them a private opportunity. He's not saying, call all those people back together and let's do a retake. He's basically saying, okay, let's just forget that first one ever happened. We'll just pretend that never happened. All you have to do is I'm going to cue up the music, and all you got to do is bow down to the statue. It's just me and the boys here. You know, no one's going to see it. We're not. But once again, what's he asking them to do? Something they can't do and stay true to the one true God. So he's given them a second chance, which I have always found fascinating. He gives them a second chance. But it doesn't change anything for them, right? And I love what they say. This is the whole point of why I chose this passage. 16 through 18.
Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God whom we serve is able to save us. He will rescue us from your power, Your Majesty. But even if he doesn't, we want to make it clear to you, Your Majesty, that we will never serve your gods or worship those that you have set up."
Okay. At the end of verse 15, just before this passage, at the end of verse 15, Nebuchadnezzar had told them what's going to happen. If you don't bow down, this second chance, you know, fiery furnace for you, and what God could possibly save you from my power? At the end of verse 15, he's saying, there's no hope for you. You better just do this because I'm the most powerful being on this entire universe, on this entire planet, and everybody knows that, and so just acknowledge that. In verse 16, how do they come back at him? With respect, yes. They call him Your Majesty, right? So they're still giving him the respect he needs to be given as a king. They're still following what God wants them to do, which is respect the king. And as much as you can, submit to the king. That's a biblical teaching in the New Testament and Old. There are times you got to submit to the government, even if you disagree with them, as long as they're not telling you to disobey God or to, you know, to worship an idol or things like that. If it comes down to the government versus God, always choose God. In this case, that's what they're faced with. Government versus God. King is telling you to worship the statue. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Don't make idols. So they can't do that. And what do they come back at them? Look, can you hear the courage in these verses? What do they say?
They'll never serve anything.
First of all, we don't have to defend ourselves against you, King. Why not? Why don't they have to defend themselves? Because our God has our defense. Our God will save us. Our God will defend us. We don't have to defend ourselves. This is not something we have to do. The battle belongs to the Lord is a biblical concept. That God of angel armies is always on your side. That's a biblical concept. And these three know that full well. How do they know that? What has been their life experience? They have seen their, as children probably, they were probably very young, but they've seen their home country conquered. They've seen Judah destroyed. They've heard about the temple in Jerusalem being destroyed. So where do they get this whole thing that God will defend us? Where do they get that from? From their history, from their faith. They remember when their people did obey God, and he did amazing things like the Red Sea crossing, like freeing them from Egypt, like feeding them with manna in the desert, like giving them the promised land, all those great miracles. They know that heritage. When we obey God, when we trust God, when we put him first, he defends us. Now, obviously, the people screw up and they sin, and so God has to allow some discipline. But these three are saying, we are true to God. We've been faithful. We have obeyed. We're not going to change that. Our entire lives, we've sought to obey God. Thus, the battle belongs to the Lord. He will defend us. We know that from our heritage, from our history, from our old, you know, they have a strong awareness of the background, all the way back to Abraham and beyond. So that's where their faith is coming from. They're saying, when we obey God, when we're faithful, we know he will defend us. But, did you notice that next part? This is how much courage they have. He will save us from the fiery furnace. But even if he doesn't, because sometimes, yeah, you pray for the miracle. You pray that God will rescue you from the fiery furnace. But where does true faith come into it? When you say, even if he doesn't, even if he doesn't, even if his will is for us to die this day, King, that doesn't change anything. We're still not going to bow down and serve your gods. We don't do that. That's not who we are. We have courage in that we have faith in this God. We have courage to trust him even if we die. Because what? Either way, they're secure, right? God may deliver the miracle, or he secures them and takes them home to be with him. Either way, it's a win. Have you heard this somewhere else before? The same teaching was last week and the week before. The same teaching was Peter sleeping in a jail cell chained up between guards. The same teaching was, you know what I mean? It's throughout Scripture. It's that confidence, that true courage, true faith can bring you to that level of courage. To say, I trust God to deliver me from the situation. I believe he'll heal me of this illness, or he'll free me from this bad situation. But even if he doesn't, I still trust him. Yeah, I still trust him. And either way, I'm going to be all right. Because if God is for us, who can be against us? Nothing can separate us from the love of God. There you go. So these three exhibit that exact same faith that you see in Peter, that you see throughout the New Testament, that you see in Jesus. Praying in the Garden of Gethsemane, that's exactly what Jesus was saying. Deliver me from this situation. Let this cup of suffering pass from me. But thy will be done. And if it cannot pass from me, if this is the way it has to go, then give me the courage. But I trust you, God. Either way. Does that make sense? It's a theme throughout the entire Bible you can see in people of faith. They get to the point of where faith takes us, where yes, you want God to rescue you. Of course you want God to heal you. Of course you want to be freed from the situation. But even if he doesn't, I'm still all right. I'm still good either way. I love that because these three stand before the king knowing there's a big blazing furnace not too far away. And he gives them a second chance, and they basically say, sorry, king, nothing's changed. We can't bow down to your statue. We don't do that. We serve the one true God. And even if it means we die, we're okay. We're secure. Comments? Thoughts? And I contest that you don't feel this courage right now. And I don't have that courage right now. But if ever faced in similar situations, we have that courage. God would provide that strength. That's what we always, well, I could never handle such and such, but God will provide if you ever have to handle that. God will provide. If you trust him and if you want that, it will be available to you. So what happens? The king goes, oh, you're right. Oh, boy, I just was wrong with this whole statue thing. Let's melt it down and have a party. Oh, wait, that's not what happens. 19 through 21.
Nebuchadnezzar was so furious with Shadrach,
Meshach,
and Abednego. But that his face became distorted with rage. He commanded that the furnace be heated 7 times hotter than usual. He ordered some of the strongest men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So they tied them up, threw them in the furnace, fully dressed in their pants, turbans, robes, and other garments.
Why the details again? You got to feel the specifics of this. You got to put yourself in the situation. Because his reaction, again, why is he so mad? Now they've defied him not once, but twice. He gave them a private opportunity to have a second chance. He gave them the special, and they basically said no. King, we don't consider you the highest authority in the universe. We worship a God that is true and higher than you, and we're not going to exchange him for you. So thanks, but no thanks. And basically, King, you can't touch us. Yeah, we know you think you're all-powerful, but you're not. So go ahead and do what you want. You throw us in that furnace, God will rescue us. And if he doesn't, then that's okay too. Either way, we're not going to bow down to you or your stupid statue. Yeah. So that's what they say. So the king flies into a furious rage. Oh, it's there in the Hebrew. The word nyeh is there, just so you know. I'm joking. But what does he do? 7 times hotter. What's that about? Yeah. That's just to show you how angry he is. Yes, he's humiliated. He's publicly shamed. He's going to, you know, if he doesn't do this, he's got a problem on his hand because he has a whole bunch of officials that are going, wait, why did we have to bow down? If those guys got away with it, why do we have to do it? And boy, that just could cause all sorts of problems. So he's got to show, he's got to kill them, but he's got to really kill them. And so he cranks up the heat seven times. Yeah, exactly. Is it necessary? No. But it's that pridefulness. He's basically going, I'm going to get these guys and I'm going to show everybody. We're going to put out the press release. It was seven times hotter than normal because King Nebuchadnezzar was so mad and he's so powerful and they just burned up, you know, the same rate they would have. But regardless, it's just all a bunch of show. And he has the strongest men in his army tie him up. Why? Again, to show off, to show his power, how great the king is and how weak these three are and yada, yada, yada. And they're thrown in, and what's the detail about their clothing? Why do you have that? Because he set...
catch on fire first.
Yeah, exactly, because the clothes are going to catch on fire first, and, you know. So it's the details, again. The author wants you to make sure you're getting drawn into the story, and you can picture it, and you can feel it, and it's just so awful. It's so terrible at this point. And they're thrown in the fiery furnace. 22 and 23...
And because the king in his anger had demanded such a hot fire in the furnace, the flames killed the soldiers as they threw the three men in. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, securely tied, fell into the roaring flame.
So just in case you haven't gotten the point yet, how hot's that fire? The people that, the guards that threw them in got burned up. Exactly right. Exactly right. Because that's how mad he is. And when this press release comes out, when this evening news shows this, man, is the kingdom going to be rocked? Because look how powerful King Nebuchadnezzar is. And how he just threw away some of his strongest soldiers because he was so mad that they got taken out in the collateral damage. And he hit the smite button, and man, did these three underlings pay. How dare you defy the king? How dare you worship some god above the king? How dare you not bow down to his stupid statue? That's not going to be allowed. So he's showing off. He's being prideful. He's allowing his emotions to get away with him, obviously. And he doesn't care what price is paid. He doesn't care if he loses soldiers. He doesn't care if innocents die. He doesn't care. He's mad. He's upset. He's a pouting little child that's going to get his way. And that this is going to be his way. He's a little, you know, he's just a little kid throwing a little tantrum. He's going to heat that up seven times hotter than normal and so on and so on. And what, did you notice they keep repeating the names over and over again? It doesn't just say, and the three were thrown in. It says, and Shadrach, Meshach. Why do they do that? Because these are your heroes. You're supposed to identify with these heroes. These are the ones who are standing true to their faith and their one true God. And they have just been imperiled like no others. But yet, you remember what Isaiah 43 said, the top of your hand out there, when you're through the fire, you will not be burned. When was Isaiah written? A simple answer of before Daniel will be fine. Before Daniel. They would have known this. They would have heard about Isaiah. They would have known these verses. Well, it's one of the reasons they can be so confident, is God had already told them they're secure. Either way, now if that verse wasn't referring to them, well then, you know, that's okay too, but... So what happens? You know the rest of the story from your little flannel graphs. By the way, who thought this is a children's story? Man, this is not a good children's story. When you actually study the details, you're like, ah! It's like a friend of mine really has a problem with the Noah's Ark being a nursery scene, you know, with your nursery decorated with all Noah's Ark and all that, because it's really not a children's... And the same with this. Some of these details are pretty gruesome when you think about it. What happens? 23 and 24? No. Where the heck am I? 24 and 25. Thank you.
But suddenly Nebuchadnezzar jumped up in amazement and exclaimed to his advisor, "Did we tie up three men and throw them into the furnace?" "Yes, Your Majesty, we certainly did," they replied. "Look," Nebuchadnezzar shouted, "I see four men, unbound, walking around in the fire unharmed, and the fourth looks like a god."
What's this about?
Well,
Think about that for a moment. First of all, when were the guards killed that threw them in? Instantaneously. You're around fire that hot? There's no, you know, it takes a few minutes. It's incineration immediately. So the guards that threw them in were incinerated. So how quickly should they have been incinerated? You know, same rate. It's not like they had flame retardant clothing on or like they had some high-tech whatever. But first of all, Nebuchadnezzar is watching. Why is he watching? It's for satisfaction, exactly right. He's going, and I want to see those flames. I want to see them for a couple minutes. I'm just going to stare at them. For a couple seconds even is too long. Because if they're truly dead, they're dead within, you know, the same time the guards are. But Nebuchadnezzar watches. That's how, first of all, prideful he is and how sick he is too. And what does he see? What's that about? Okay, why that? Yeah, exactly. Okay, so this is one of those times when I love God because he has such a great sense of humor, but also a sense of drama. He could have done it so the three are thrown in and they bounce right back. He could have done that, right?
Yeah.
He's obviously determined to save them at this point. He's going to do a miracle. So they could have bounced right back out. Or they could have just popped out, you know, like a toaster. You push your little Pop-Tart down sometimes and it pops right back up. That could have happened. Or they could have, the fire could have been extinguished. They're thrown in and the fire, you know, through God's miraculous power is quenched immediately. You've seen that happen before. God works instantaneously like that. Why not that way? God has this sense of drama and he has a sense of humor. And he basically wants to show that when he has chosen to do something, Nebuchadnezzar has no power. He's essentially taking all the power away, going, okay, yeah, go ahead and heat that furnace up 7 times hotter. That's fine. Yeah, that's okay. You know what? My guys were bound by strong men. They were tightly tied when they were thrown in. And what happened to those ties? Oh, yeah. No big deal. No big deal. You know, and the ties weren't burned off. We'll see that in a couple minutes. The ties weren't burned off. They just, God released them through his miraculous power. And interestingly enough, the whole thing that catches Nebuchadnezzar's attention, he sees four. First of all, he sees people walking around inside the furnace. That's miracle number one. Miracle number two that catches attention is, wait, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. 1, 2, 3. You know, and he has to check his math. He has to check his recollection. Wait, I know I was really ticked off and I was really angry, but didn't we throw three? He has to check his math. He has to check his, I thought there were three. Did I miss something? And his advisors, I love his advisors, are going, we don't want to call you a nutcase, but you really are. Yes, O king, uh-huh, yeah, it was three. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir, we saw it, three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And then he goes, there's four. And what's the third miracle here? What's the appearance of the third?
Unbound.
Well, they're all unbound, yeah. Walk. The fourth appears like? Yeah. So we don't know what that is. If that's extra brightness or if that's, we don't know what he means by that. There's two theories of who that is. So who is it? The first explanation is an angel, that God sent an angel to free them and to comfort them and to give them. The second theory is it's one of those pre-Bethlehem appearances of Jesus, of the Son of God. It could be either one. We don't know. We have no hint whatsoever. There's some great theories that God, this situation was so important that he sent his son to be present with them. But either way, it's the same thing. An angel or the son shows great care for these three. God could have released them in any way he wanted, but he chose to do it in a very personal way. He sent comfort. He sent release. He sent security. Because think about what those three experienced. You know, think about you being tied up and being heaved towards that mighty hot furnace. Picture the fact that you can feel how hot that is from pretty far away. And you're getting closer and closer, and the guys that throw you in are burned up. And God says to you, don't be afraid. I gotcha. In fact, here's a tangible representative to help you, to make sure you know. And they're just strolling around, and as Karen said, maybe they're dancing, doing a little jig, maybe they're... Because think about the joy that it is when you're in the midst of a terrible trial and it can't touch you. When you're in the midst of something that should destroy you, but it doesn't. And those of you who've been through difficult trials, you know this feeling. When you realize, wait, God's helping me, and God's carrying me, and God's getting me through this, and wow, this should totally crush me, but it's not, because God is on my side, and I feel that, I know that. Now, you don't always feel that in the midst of it. Sometimes you do, but it's kind of when you're almost, when you see the light at the end of the tunnel, and you realize, wow, thank you, God, for providing, and there's such joy that can come at that moment, going, God, you are real, you do have this, you're carrying me right now, wow, that's so amazing. So just I love the fact that he sees four, and this again is a God thing. God didn't have to do it this way. He chose to do it this way for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but also to prove a point to little Nebi. Because Nebi thinks himself all king of the world, but God's going, not so much. Not so much. 26, 27?
Then Nebuchadnezzar came as close as he could to the door of the flaming furnace and shouted, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out. Come here. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego stepped out of the fire. Then the high officers, officials, governors, and advisors crowded around them and saw that the fire had not touched them. Not a hair on their heads was singed, and their clothing was not scorched. They didn't even smell of smoke.
I love the details. Good old Nebi gets as close as he can. He's not willing to get burned up, so he goes as close as he can. And what does he call out? He does it himself. He doesn't have one of his officials that do it. He's so enthralled by this. And again, I think he had that special place in his heart for these three. And he was pretty mad at them, obviously, but there's still something in him that goes, wow. So he gets as close as he can, and he calls out. He calls them by name, doesn't he? That shows, you know, that he's there's something going on here where he's going, wait, could this really be true? Could you? And how does he refer to them? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, yes, but what else? Servants of the Most High God. Now, he's had an experience with Daniel, so he knows who this, and he's kind of going, wait, whoa. You mean there must be someone higher than me? There's some God that's above me? And he's starting to get that realization of going, this is beyond what I could have expected, and oh my goodness, and servants of the Most High God. And what does he want them to do? Come on out. What the heck? Why are you still there? Tell me about this. This is a miracle. Oh my God. And there's something about him where he's gone from raging anger to not quite humility, but at least on the road to humility, where he's at least questioning, going, what did I just witness? He's questioning, he's seeking, he's uncertain, and he wants them to come out because they obviously haven't been killed. And when they come out, first of all, they emerge from the fire, miracle number like 17. And what's the details you're given?
They weren't even singed.
They weren't even singed. Didn't smell of smoke. Not even a hair on their head was burned. Talk about your protection. That's why I think the ropes were severed not by the fire, because if they'd been burned up, that would have touched them, right?
Yeah.
But somehow the ropes are gone through God's miraculous power, through the angel or through the son that he sent. There's not even a sign that they've been in the fire. They don't smell of smoke. They don't have any hint of that. This is a God thing.
I don't think Nebuchadnezzar really knew what was going on, and he wanted them to come out to see if it was really them.
Yep. He has no clue. He is so befuddled. He is so, he doesn't have a clue. How would you respond? I mean, 1 minute you think you're king of the world. Everybody bows down to you except these three, and I'm going to take care of them. And then the next minute, wait, what the heck's going on? And so, yes. Yes. Who have I gone up against again? Wait. Seven times hotter, and they're walking around, and there's a fourth in there that looks like a god. What have I taken on, and I better look into this at least. So he calls them out, and notice there's witnesses. He calls over the officials and the others that are part of this whole scene, and they all gather around and witness these three have not been touched. How's it close out? Last verses?
Then Nebuchadnezzar said, "Praise to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He sent his angel to rescue his servants who trusted in him. They defied the king's command and were willing to die rather than serve or worship any god except their own god. Therefore, I make this decree. If any people, whatever their race or nation or language, speak a word against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they will be torn limb from limb, and their houses will be turned into heaps of rubble. There is no other God who can rescue like this." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to even higher positions in the province of Babylon.
Why this ending?
Yeah,
they're the heroes. The heroes have to have a reward at the end for their faithfulness. They're promoted. But so interesting, because Nebuchadnezzar never actually says, "I will worship this God." What does he say? "Thou shalt not speak a word against this God," upon penalty of some pretty severe penalties. And he basically is saying, there's something special about this God. I don't quite understand it. I don't quite know what to do with this, but there is certainly an authority higher than me, and we're going to at least establish that. That's a pretty big change for him, and it's because of what he's witnessed. He's witnessed this amazing reality. What about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Yeah, they get promoted, and at this point, life looks pretty good for them, and we never hear of them again. So they live happily ever after is how we can leave it. That's all we know. I wish we knew more, but when we hang out with them in heaven, you can ask them what happened next. We don't know. But I think they're great examples of courage in the face of pretty difficult circumstances when you think about it. And the idea that you stand firm for your faith regardless of the price that is paid. And hopefully none of us are ever put in this situation. But I think on a daily basis, you have challenges that maybe aren't quite the fiery furnace. But you have challenges in your life as well that require you to say, "Okay, God, I'm going to pray for the miracle, but I'm going to prepare for reality. And either way, you have it. Either way, you have me. And the God of angel armies is always on my side. And I'm going to be okay with this, no matter what happens." That's the faith that it takes to walk forward some days in your life and have that courage. And God will provide that. I think he did for these three, and it worked out pretty awesome for them. Not always will it be happily ever after for you, but I think you can take great confidence in knowing that God is in control and that even through this situation, God had it taken care of. Questions? Comments?
Question. When I was researching this, I found these details about the statue, one that the king had dreamed about and he had yet helped. And it breaks it all down into all these different errors and what the hand meant. Is that the same statue they're talking about? Or is that, I got confused.
Yeah, I don't know, actually. That's a good question. There is,
you know,
I think
what
that's,
I'm talking about,
yes.
They said the head of gold mm-hmm. and the feet of
I think that's referring to, I think that's referring to a different statue that's in Revelation. Revelation 1 has a statue of Jesus, essentially, where Jesus is a living statue, and it talks about.
But the Bible, I mean, I was using the internet.
Yeah.
And it gave references of Daniel 2:36-38, the dream
yeah.
that he the king had, and it breaks it all down.
Yeah.
That's where I got confused.
Yeah. No, that's a good question. I think that Daniel 2 relates more to the end times, and that Nebuchadnezzar misinterpreted it and thought he needed to build a statue himself. That's probably the only connection.
Okay, that makes
but
sense.
it's a different statue, but the dreams in Daniel usually are both present day for Daniel's day and end times, both. And that's what gets confusing is, and Nebuchadnezzar took it as, "Oh, I need to build a statue now." And Daniel had never told him that, but Nebuchadnezzar got confused. So, yeah. Other questions? That's a good question, though. Any other comments, questions, complaints? All right, let me pray. God, we thank you for this lesson in which we understand that sometimes courage is required that's beyond ourselves. We thank you for the trust, the faith of these three, and what a model it is for us, Lord, that we too can step out and have such faith and trust you. Regardless of circumstances, Lord, we know that whether you deliver a miracle, an answer prayer in the way we would wish, or whether you follow a plan that we can't understand sometimes, we know you can be trusted that you have us secure and that that is where we need to reside, is in that security, knowing that nothing can separate us from your love, especially through Christ Jesus. We thank you, Lord, for all that reality, and we ask you to give us the strength and the grace for this day and every day to walk forward in that courage. In your name we pray. Amen.